If an unborn child is exposed to alcohol while in utero, it can be affected for life. Fetal alcohol spectrum disorder may affect 20 to 50 children out of 1,000, and the severest effect is called fetal alcohol syndrome, which is estimated to affect 3 cases per 1,000 in America. So how much alcohol must a woman drink during pregnancy to have an affected child, and what are the effects? Stand by, Go Healthy for Good starts right now. Hello, I'm Dr. Nerida. Welcome to Go Healthy for Good. Our story today is brought to us from the National Organization on Fetal Alcohol Syndrome, an organization committed solely to the prevention, advocacy, and support of fetal alcohol syndrome disorder. Meet Jasmine. Here is her story.
I am one of nine in the O'Connor family. I was adopted when I was five. I came into the O'Connor's family when I was about 2.5 months old, because my mother pretty much abandoned me and my sister when my sister was 18 months old. I was 2.5 months old. So we came immediately to the O'Connor family. It took us 5 years to get adopted. And during that time, my parents kind of noticed that there was something a little off between two of us. I slept for 24 hours a day and didn't really wake up unless I was woken up to eat. So I got an early diagnosis at the age of 3. Which was really important, because then I got early intervention involved. I got a lot of speech therapy, occupational therapy, really helped me to just get a grasp on life, really. If I was in like an English class and they were talking about a book I wasn't particularly interested in, just started a lecture, I just like start thinking of like crazy stuff, like, oh, what did I eat for breakfast this morning? And just totally divert myself from what was going on in the classroom. And then by the time class wrapped up and I have a homework assignment, I'd be like, uh-oh. I had this thing where I would count the tiles on the ceiling in my classroom, especially if I was extremely nervous about it, so I'd just start counting them. If I was given 2 hours, I would try to cram as much in, and if I didn't finish, I'd be so frustrated. I wouldn't get through the test. So eventually my IEP called for me to get extended time. So I was able to complete tests to the best of my ability. And I was actually taken out of the classroom, which helped a lot, because all the, you know, distractions are just removed and I could complete my tests. When I got through high school, what really helped me was I was involved with sports. I did basketball and softball. But I found that I could not memorize plays in basketball, so I sat the bench quite a bit. And they kind of just put me in, like, you know, get the ball, Jazz. And I got the ball, and I would, like, you know, score. Did really, really well. Graduated. Yay. First in my biological family, by the way.
Yay, indeed. What a testament to devoted parents, specialized education, and hard work. In today's lineup, we have a highly acclaimed researcher of the fetal environment, an unusual dish in the kitchen, and Sean will be here later to put us through our paces. But first, the news. In the headlines today, early maturing girls need extra parental supervision and women still drink in pregnancy. Girls who reach puberty early are at much higher risk of alcohol abuse if their parents don't supervise them well, according to research published in the journal Pediatrics. Early maturing girls whose parents didn't keep tabs on them at age 13 showed a dramatic increase in alcohol abuse over the next 4 years, compared with early maturing peers whose parents were more attentive. And the more frequent the alcohol misuse, the less closely parents supervised. Perhaps parents are thinking their daughters are more mature than they actually are, or that their more mature friends can actually be trusted. Maybe they just gave up trying. But the bottom line is that kids whose parents pay attention to what they're doing and who they're doing it with are less likely to do unhealthy things. Despite national guidelines that advise against alcohol consumption in early pregnancy, a number of recent studies find that this advice is being ignored. In Ireland, the UK, Europe, Australia, and New Zealand, 70 to 90% of women are consuming alcohol prior to pregnancy recognition. And then, after pregnancy is diagnosed, that number drops to between 15 and 70% who consume 1 to 2 units per week during the critical first 3 months of fetal development. Then 20 to 30% continue to drink during the second and third trimesters. Women who smoke are also more likely to drink, and that combination increases the risk of premature birth, lower birth weight, growth restriction, respiratory disease, brain abnormalities, and behavioural and intellectual impairment later in life. Most women who consume alcohol in pregnancy have one glass once a month or less, though a Dutch study shows a trend towards drinking 1 to 3 glasses or more on occasion. In the US, Germany, and the Netherlands, it's the over 30s and the most educated women who are most likely to drink during pregnancy. Though really, it's only the smartest who don't touch a drop before, during, or after pregnancy. I'm Dr. Nerida McKibben, and that's today's health news. Joining us in the studio today is Dr. Peter Landless, Executive Director of the International Commission for the Prevention of Alcoholism and Drug Dependency, and Dr. Al Rees, Dean of the University of Maryland School of Medicine. Dr. Rees is actively involved in pioneering research on diabetes and pregnancy and birth defects. I asked him to share some of his discoveries.
You know, it's interesting that even though a pregnancy is 9 months in length in general, the first 2 months are the most critical period for things to go wrong. And so when the fetus is exposed to various types of external agents that are toxic, in my particular case, I study diabetes as a model, but it can be applied to other circumstances. And we have found that that is a period of it's a period of vulnerability, where insults can cause developmental alterations and birth defects that children will be born with. So our research has been, we've used an animal model to try to simulate what happens in the human, and have been able to replicate very much what the birth defects are, and we're now in the process of developing means by which we can prevent those birth defects from occurring.
I want to congratulate you on your research. It is world altering, the research that you're doing. So
thank
congratulations
you.
On that. Tell us, you know, we see, as an obstetrician, I see some women that do awful things during their pregnancy, and they seem to sail through and produce a healthy baby, apparently healthy baby, and others do everything right, and yet things don't go that well. How vulnerable is the fetus in the uterus during that time?
The fetus is extremely vulnerable. I would say the first 8 weeks in particular is when the organs are being formed, and they typically undergo a rotation in their developmental sequence. And that's a period of time when it's highly vulnerable. But what's interesting, the vulnerability is multifaceted. It's multifaceted based on, one, the actual dosage of whatever that happens to be. Also, the length of exposure and the particular period of development. So different birth defects will occur if the exposure occurs at 4 weeks versus 8 weeks. And if it occurs for long periods of time or short periods of time. So those are some of the variabilities that actually will influence the actual outcome and the type of birth defects that is formed.
Mm. Now, of course, the placenta is the transition point between the mother and the fetus, and it will let some chemicals, medication, drugs through, and others won't be allowed through. Dr. Landless, tell us, does alcohol transfer through the placenta?
Sadly, it does. And, you know, there are a number of barriers in the body, physiological barriers. For example, as you've said, that keep certain chemicals from affecting certain organs. That's a problem when one wants to get certain antibiotics into a certain site. There is the lining of the blood vessel, the lining of the organ concerned. But sadly, both for the brain and for the baby, the alcohol very readily penetrates both through the placenta and in adults and in children and anybody into the brain as well. So it traverses or gets across at a very, very rapid and easy rate into the fetus and affects the brain.
More from our experts after the break, but first, this.
I love getting out of that stuffy house into this beautiful fresh air, even though it's a bit cold.
It's cold, all right. But you're right, outdoor air is much healthier than indoor.
People spend 90% of their time indoors, thus exposing themselves to dangerous particles and gases.
Dangerous particles and gases. Well, you're right. I guess we do build our houses and our offices pretty airtight so that we can control temperature and humidity. But that makes for poor ventilation. But where do the gases and the particles come from?
Well, the gases in the summertime come from our air conditioning systems, and in the wintertime they come from our heating systems.
And the dangerous particles?
Well, they come from carpeting, ceiling tiles, ventilation, pets, and just a whole bunch of places.
So you combine that with poor ventilation, and you get an escalation in the concentration of the gases and the particles.
Yes, and these particles are dangerous for us, and they can even put us at risk for cancer.
And if we have poor ventilation, the other problem is that carbon dioxide levels increase as we're breathing that out, and oxygen levels decrease.
That's right. So having said that, I think we ought to get on our bikes and go get that fresh air.
Good idea.
Hey, wait for me.
Well, hurry up. Doctor's orders.
Come on.
Welcome to the kitchen, and Phil is cooking again.
Yeah, thank you. I'm very excited to be here today.
What are we rustling up today?
Well, with nice weather, I like to get outside and grill, so I brought something that's not your traditional grilling food.
So it's not a steak, a sausage?
Completely different. We're grilling romaine lettuce.
Lettuce?
Lettuce. And a lot of people don't think that it can be cooked. You have to be very careful because it can be temperamental, but it's kind of a fun thing, especially if you have guests at your house. It's kind of a fun thing to show them.
Well, what goes in it?
Well, with this one, it's 3 to 4 romaine hearts, 3 tablespoons of olive oil, 1 tablespoon of fresh lime juice, 2 teaspoons of chopped fresh herbs such as rosemary, thyme, oregano, and then 1/4 teaspoon of salt.
Sounds interesting.
It's very interesting.
I like lime juice with greens, so.
It goes very well. It's a very simple dressing. So I'm gonna start cutting this, and I'm gonna have you mix our ingredients.
Okay.
And one thing to remember is we have 2 tablespoons of herbs. If you were to use dried, you only want 1 tablespoon because it kind of gets smaller as it dries. So
It's
a little more concentrated. So while you're mixing that, we're going to cut off the top of our romaine.
And put that in the salad.
Don't throw it away. It's very good. We've actually already kind of shaved off the bottom a little bit. But you want to keep it all together.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how we're going to cook it. So I'm just going to cut it right down the center.
Romaine is a great lettuce. It's the best in terms of nutrition, though it is, and I guess that's why you're using it for grilling, is it's a little tougher. It's wonderful lettuce for juicing. It's my favorite for juicing.
And it's great for that because it has a mild flavor, more mild than other lettuces. This is great because it holds together, and it also has a little bit of a water content, so it's not just going to wilt right away.
Right.
But it's a little bit easier because you can kind of lay this on the grill and just kind of keep it there. So you're doing exactly the next part, which is great. We're just going to basically
kind of... It was just begging for it.
We're going to cover this with our mixture. And you've got a little bit of a life hack there. You don't need to buy expensive tools in the kitchen.
No, I do this often. I just use a paper towel if I don't have a brush handy, and it just works fine.
And then what we're going to do is we're going to grill this. Now, actually, while it's on the grill, you can hear it sizzle. I love the sizzle.
Yeah. So we can do this on the outdoor grill.
I imagine
that's really fun.
And you're going to want a really high heat with this because you don't want to cook it for long. You just want to cook it quickly.
Oh, just sear the outside. Yeah. Oops, sorry.
This is going to give it a great flavor. It's going to also help it while it cooks. And this is one little thing. I'm used to growing up, and romaine lettuce can be found pretty much anywhere in grocery stores. It's very easy to find.
It didn't all year round.
All year round. Yeah. It's grown all year round. It's very easy for us to get.
Yeah.
It actually became popular once the Caesar salad got invented. And that's why we have it everywhere. Before then, it was really just iceberg and a few other lettuces.
Don't do iceberg. All it is packaged water. Whereas this has got some nutrition in it. Look how dark those leaves are. All that chlorophyll. Look at that.
So after about a minute, it's a good idea to turn it, and you want to actually kind of turn it a few times.
Oh, okay, so it's going to go back and forth a wee bit.
It's going to go back for a few times, about 4 to 5 minutes for the whole thing. But you want to basically give it a little bit of a heat. You want it to be a little bit warm. It's great if it has those grill marks.
Yeah.
But you don't want to actually cook it to where it's wilted and soft and all that stuff. So you want to just cook it briefly.
All right.
And then as you can see, we cut it up. You can leave it whole and put it on the plate, or you can cut it up, and we've kind of paired it here with some roasted vegetables. You could use fresh vegetables, especially if you've got your own garden.
And if you're grilling, you might even have skewered vegetables, you know, your bell peppers and all that. Well, I'm going to try this. I'm going to try a little piece here.
It's good, isn't it?
Isn't it good? That lime juice is really nice.
I love lime paired with this. And I just love, and I think people even really just enjoy the fact that it's some cooked romaine lettuce, which is completely different from the usual.
Yeah, right. Well, thanks for that recipe.
Sure.
I'm going to try that. That was a dish with a difference. Jasmine was born with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, or FASD. She was adopted into a healthy home, diagnosed at 3 years of age, and received specialized education. She was the first in her biological family to graduate from high school. However, life is still a struggle. Watch.
By the time I got to college, I hit a big speed bump because I was roomed with two alcoholics. Upon moving in, they were drunk and really would just drink all day, every day. So I ended up dropping out of college because of it. Shortly after college, I got pregnant with my son. And he's going to be two in a few weeks. And that's a really big struggle. I have my support set up. My mom, she really helps me out. She watches him a lot while I work. I work two jobs. I'm a housekeeper for a nursing home. I also work in a deli. I called my mother a lot because she raised 9 kids, you know. So I'm constantly, to this day, on the phone with my mom. I'm like, he's doing this. Is that normal? You know, what should I do? How do I approach this? Me having FASD, I know I don't have the answers. You know what I mean? And I have that disadvantage. You know, I'm very concrete. I'm like, okay, this is the problem. What's the solution? And babies aren't that black and white. You know, you can't. It's not always, okay, this is the solution. It might take you months, years to find the solution, you know. But I think the biggest thing that helped me was asking for help. Working in a deli is pretty much one of the hardest things I've ever done because you have a lot of tasks and they're not written down in front of you. I can only work at night. Because that way all the stuff that's supposed to be put out, because in a deli you also put out cheese and salads, pre-baked pizzas and all this other stuff, all that's already done. So all I have to do is focus on a couple things. And I mean, it's really hard. I had to find a job that would accommodate me like that. But before I worked at Wendy's, I had to do everything. It was just really overwhelming. I can't ever have an office job. I would go nuts. I'd be like, yeah, when's break? You know, I definitely have to have a job where you're constantly moving. It's just, that's how I just do things. I appear normal. I can express myself well, but certain situations I definitely misread that most people don't misread. I might think that you're mad at me, but you might have just been joking with me. You know what I'm saying? And I think some people that don't know me but do know about FAS, they think that I'm more affected than I am. So they talk to me really slow and like, do you understand? And it's frustrating. I'm like, you don't have to do that. It's like, I know you're trying to be nice and everything, but like, treat them like a person, okay? Like, you wouldn't talk to your friends like that.
Which is not a lot to ask. Now, back to our discussion with Dr. Peter Landless and Dr. Al Rees. We used to think that our health destiny was determined by our genes and to a limited extent by our environment. However, there have been some interesting advances in the last few decades that show a stronger link between the environment of our mothers who are pregnant with us and our health as adults. Here's Dr. Rees to explain more.
Well, this is a fascinating area. And if I may just for a second, I recall about 30 years ago, I met a very famous professor from England, Professor David Barker. And I was a trainee at the time, and he came to the United States and was actually promoting a concept called, at the time it was simply that certain adult diseases, heart disease and hypertension, actually had their origins in utero. And it seemed very strange. Why is a fetus's exposure affecting a mother and father in their 50s or 60s? Well, it turns out that after large studies have done over decades, in fact, Professor Barker was correct. So now it's called the Barker hypothesis, or if you will, called adult diseases of fetal origin. And it really is the exposure that a fetus gets in utero to various toxins. But in particular, what's interesting is that he has shown a marker that fetuses that are particularly small, the lower the birth weight of the fetus, the higher the risk of heart disease, strokes, hypertension, and diabetes.
Dr. Landless, does alcohol consumption by women during pregnancy cause fetal origin diseases?
Unquestionably. You know, it's one of those where it's not an association, it's causally related. And why I mentioned the causal component, some illnesses are more associated with exposure to certain things. Here we know that alcohol is an absolute definite toxin to the fetus, to the unborn baby, and many organs are vulnerable to it. But one of those which shows up quite clearly in the behavioral patterns and mental and intellectual capacity is the brain. And it really is vulnerable to the alcohol which is consumed.
So Dr. Rees, take us through, we used to think there was just one disease, but there's now a spectrum of problems.
That's true.
Talk us through that.
I think as Dr. Landless just said, certainly it's the alcohol is not an associate, it's really causal. And so many years ago, we would sometimes say fetal alcohol syndrome. Well, now it's called fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. Mm-hmm. Because in fact, the spectrum can go from just low birth weight, not just, but that may be the only gross manifestation, or there could be certain facial abnormalities, or the head size could be small, or there could be birth defects of the heart and the kidneys, or there could be fetal death. So the range can be very, 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 very wide, from very minor or relatively minor manifestation to rather severe ones. So that's one of the reasons why it's now, sometimes you'll see the acronym FASD.
Mm. Now, we know that alcohol, as you both mentioned, really does hone in on the brain, or mm-hmm. the brain is particularly susceptible to the influence of alcohol. Does a baby born under the influence of alcohol, shall we say, does their brain look different if we scanned the brain? Could we see a change?
There are two aspects to your question. Number one, if you scan the brain, you do not necessarily see changes, because the changes are microscopic at the time of birth. And the scans, unless you go into molecular scanning, which one doesn't really have always the facility to do, gross scanning, or looking at a CT scan, what's called a CAT scan, computer tomography of the brain, will not necessarily show changes. There may be size differences, but again, as Dr. Rees has pointed out, a low-weight baby would have a smaller brain in proportion to the body size of the baby. So the scan may not necessarily be different, but what is very important to note is that the actual neurological manifestations, what do we mean by that? The symptoms which are controlled by the nervous system in the brain, jitteriness, restlessness, inability to suckle. Many of those kind of symptoms, which are mediated by the function of the brain, are often very obvious at birth.
And those
babies
are very
exposed.
Right, and those are very classic symptoms.
Absolutely.
Of addiction. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, Dr. Reese, you mentioned the face. What specifically might you see in a baby looking at its face?
It's actually quite characteristic. I mean, if you've seen one, it's not very hard to pick up another one. Typically, the head is small. You may have the what's called the philtrum, which is really the space between the tip of the nose and the tip of the mouth, is wider. The nose bridge typically is wider or flattened, and sometimes the head is small. Yeah. It's a very usually a flat, classic appearance with a flat face and flat nose, and just you can be very suspicious once you see the baby and see those faces.
Mm. And many of those features persist into later life.
That's correct.
And you can actually see it, and clinicians have mm-hmm. picked this up. You can pick it up in adolescence as well.
So we've looked at the brain, what the face might look like. Now, you've also mentioned behavior. Mm. So tell us, Dr. Landless, behaviorally, as these, obviously a newborn, you've mentioned some of the newborn behavioral differences, that jitteriness, but as they start to grow, what do we see in behavior?
There's a huge spectrum of, and I think that term spectrum is very important.
It is.
There's a huge spectrum of behavioral issues and also intellectual problems which these unfortunate individuals face. It's fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. Brain effects manifest in many ways throughout life. They can be inability to concentrate, inability to learn. There can be significant mental retardation, difficulty in focusing, difficulty in carrying out tasks. And so these are all to a greater or lesser degree, depending on the amount of exposure. But one of the things I saw when I was a family practitioner, before I went to specialize, I saw learning disabilities. And that is a tremendous issue to the individual and the family. And here in the United States, multiple millions of dollars are spent annually, and not enough of them to combat the problems, but purely as a result of exposure to alcohol in the fetus, resulting in difficulties in behavioral issues. So it can go from the spectrum of significant mental retardation, not being able to learn adequately, having difficulty in learning, concentration issues, etc. So it has a wide spectrum of manifestation and very, very debilitating or disabling in the long term to the individual who has them.
So if we look at a teenager, what might a teenager who has been affected by fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, how might they behave?
You know, Dr. Landless actually made the earlier point that unfortunately many of the manifestations persist. It's not just a in utero problem or an infant problem or even a young child problem. It's a persistent problem. So first of all, the structural features remain, remain. And the behavioral disorders often will remain, and the learning problems. These problems that Dr. Landless described in early childhood actually persist. So it'll be a teenager that really is a troubled child, unfortunately.
We have more about this after the break, so stay with us, and meantime, consider this. In the Old Testament book of Judges, we find the story of Samson. His mother was infertile, but God visited her and told her she would soon be pregnant. He advised her to avoid all alcohol. She learned that her son would do an important work for God and that he was never to drink alcohol. Samson often defended his nation from marauding Philistines, and though he had a weakness for women, he never consumed alcohol. And at the end of the story, he finally died a hero. In the New Testament, John the Baptist's mother, Elizabeth, was infertile, and her husband had a heaven-sent visitor announcing that soon they would have a baby boy, and they were to name him John. John was to do an important work for God, but he must never drink alcohol. Right from birth, he would be filled with the Holy Spirit.
Luke says that the boy John grew, became strong in spirit, and ended up being their greatest prophet of all time. Even thousands of years ago, God wanted to protect unborn children from alcohol. And his desire is to give every child the absolute best start in life so they can reach their fullest potential. I'm sure you want to do the same, so follow these wonderful examples. Well, it's that time again. Time to get moving. Sean, good to see you.
Good to see you too.
What have you got for us?
So we're going to use very simple simple tools today, a resistant band. And we're going to work together as a team, all right? So I want you to grab somebody to work out with you. We're going to do two exercises individually, but I want you to do them simultaneously with your partner, okay? I want you to pick a rep between 15 and 20. Go a little bit higher. Today's about burning fat and calories, okay? So we're going to work a little bit faster, okay? So what you're going to do is, well, actually, you know, we got to get warmed up. You can't just start like that.
We got to get warmed up. Yes,
we do. Not a good thing. All right, we're going to start with some jumping jacks. Since what we're going to do is a little bit faster, all right, we're going to start with 5 jumping jacks in 3, 2, and 1. Go. I'm going to do the modified version where you don't have to do any impact. Okay? 3, 2, and 1. Dynamic exercises, warm the body, heart rate goes up, prepare you for exercise.
All right,
so grab your resistant band. All right, what we're going to do are high pulls. We're working the V, all right? The delts. There are 3 heads to the delts, and we're going to work the entire delt area. This is what everyone sees when you wear a dress, tank top, all that good stuff.
All right.
Okay, so we're going to target it, and here we go. Moving a little bit fast, we're going to go to about 8. All right, you and I are going to go to 8, but I want you to go to 15, okay?
All right.
A little bit faster. This is the full position here. Boom. Okay, we're going to go in 3, 2, 1. Go. 1, 2, 3. 4, 5, 3 more, 6, 7, 8. I'm doing 1 more for good luck. All right, so once you got your 8, you got your 15, we're doing our 8 here. We're gonna go right into a very fast, you can do an alternating bicep curl or you can do both together. 30 seconds, nonstop, all right?
Whoa.
We're not gonna go 30 seconds because I don't wanna wear you out.
Come on, come on.
All right, ready? 3, 2, and 1, go. So what you want to do here is burn the calories, burn the fat, and just kind of feel that burn.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
After a while, your body just gets a little warmer, all right? I'm starting to sweat a little bit.
You're slowing down,
keep it going.
Cheer him on.
Come on. Keep it going, keep it going, keep it going, keep it going, keep it going. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1.
Oh, I can feel the burn. I bet
I feel
you
that
can.
Burn. Yeah.
Yeah.
So then with your partner, we can either, you can use that one.
All right.
You both have a seat. Okay. And partner one is going to work at one time and then partner two will work next. Okay. What you're going to do is take here, bring it to the side.
So here we're working our abs.
Yes.
And our obliques on the sides.
Yeah, there you go. All the way to the side.
And of course, you're working your core because you're leaning.
Your turn. There you go. So count off for 30 seconds, 30 reps, whatever you choose. There you go. The more you bring it to the side, the more you work that whole abdominal area. 3, 2, and 1. Nice. There you go.
Whew.
You got me sweating.
We have. Sean.
But that feels good because what we want to do is work at a higher pace, work a different cardiovascular system, and then keep on repeating that. Okay, so set your timer, all right? 30 seconds each exercise, all right? And then repeat it again. Do it for maybe about 3 times, okay? All right, let's cool it down, all right? What we're gonna do is take this leg here, bring it right behind you, point your knee down, push your hips forward, and 3, 2, 1, switch. Switch them up. Take a nice deep breath. All right, relax. Both feet a little bit wider than shoulder width apart. Right down to the middle. The further you can go down, the better. And be patient with this because at the first time that you're doing it, you may not go down as far, but the more you breathe and relax, the more you can reach down. And come up nice and slow. Take it out. feel good.
Oh, yeah.
Heart rate is up.
You're glowing.
I am.
Shiny.
I feel good, that's why.
Thanks, Shiny Sean.
Yeah. You're very welcome.
Researchers for the Adventist Health Study wondered, can a vegetarian diet provide adequate vitamin D, which is found primarily in animal products? Interestingly, no real difference was found in vitamin D levels based on diet. Researchers found instead that the people with the highest vitamin D levels were those who spent enough time in the sun. Safe but regular sun exposure seems to be the best way to get your vitamin D. Regular time outside in the sun is another ageless advantage.
Now for the questions you've sent me via Facebook, text, phone, and email. Sandra wrote, can you have endometriosis after having your uterus removed but still having your ovaries? Yes, that's definitely possible and not that uncommon, actually. If the ovaries are preserved, it's often the place that endometriosis is already residing. And the endometriosis will then continue to be stimulated by the hormones coming from the ovaries. So sometimes other hormones are used to block the effect of ovaries for a while after the uterus is removed in the hope that it will knock out the endometriosis that exists at the time of hysterectomy. One concerned grandma wrote, I'm worried about my 5-year-old grandson who's always catching the flu as soon as he starts going to nursery school. Yeah, that's pretty common. Is there anything we can do to boost his immunity? Please help. He's having way too many antibiotics because of complications, tonsillitis, or mouth ulcers. Well, for flu, antibiotics are not helpful. It's not going to make any difference at all because flu is caused by a virus. So unless he really needs them, just ride through that storm. Just give him supportive care with plenty to drink and lots of TLC. Probiotics are a great immune booster, but the very best immune booster is a healthy diet, avoiding sugar, getting plenty of exercise and sleep. Gargling once a day, I don't know how old he is, but if he could gargle once a day, he could reduce his viral illnesses by 30%. We can all do that. If he does get a viral infection, he could have a herbal extract called UMCA, U-M-C-K-A, that halves the severity and reduces the duration. It's quite safe for children, and it comes in a liquid, so it's easy for them to take. If mouth ulcers are a problem, try giving him 1/4 of a teaspoon of coconut oil each day. It just might drive them away. Another caller asked, how do we get the sleep apnea mouthpiece? Well, see your dentist or your doctor. You can't just get it over the counter. Someone else called, what's the difference between stevia and raw stevia? You said stevia had a glycemic index of 0, but is that true for raw stevia? Well, stevia is extracted from the sweet leaves of a stevia plant, which you can actually grow yourself. And if you grow the plant, you'll realize as you eat the leaves that there's no difference in the calorie content between raw or processed stevia. There's just no calories there at all. It's a very sweet bush. And if you don't eat a lot of it, then you're not going to drive your sweet teeth to eat all those extra high-sugared, high-fat foods. So don't have too much, but it is 0 calories. Thanks for those questions. I love to hear from you, so keep sending them in. Now let's go shopping. Strawberries were mentioned in ancient Roman literature in references to their medicinal uses. The French brought them wild from the forest into their gardens in the 1300s. Art in the Renaissance used the strawberry to symbolize perfect righteousness, and at that time, the plant was used to treat depression. Now it's rightfully used for food. Mostly eaten raw, but with high-calorie additives like sugar and cream. However, they are so yummy, just as they are. High in fiber and potassium, research shows that they boost the immune system. They're antioxidant, and they're mildly anti-inflammatory. They may have benefits against cancer, aging, inflammation, eye health, and neurological disease. Some people are allergic to the red ones, so those people might want to try the white ones instead. Bon appetit. Older adults who drink alcohol tend to be more consistent drinkers. More and more young people are binge drinking, and it's young women who get pregnant.
Up to 50% of pregnancies are unplanned, and so during those first few critical weeks before pregnancy is diagnosed, there can be significant alcohol exposure. I asked Dr. Reese if binging carries more risk to the fetus.
They are, actually. And just so we know what we're talking about here with the number, studies have shown, have tried to characterize what binge drinking is. And typically it's 4 to 5 or more glasses of wine or beer per day. And often, again, as I said earlier, the fetal effects are, is actually dose related.
Now, when you say a day, you mean in one session?
Yes.
Yep. And I think it would happen maybe even just once a week.
It may, exactly. It may just be once a week, but it's actually that many glasses. But the point I want to emphasize is that it's dose-related. So if someone is binge drinking, the likelihood of fetal injury is going to be greater than someone who is drinking moderately. There's no safe dose, but nevertheless, higher doses have actually greater impact.
Right, and I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Landless, but I believe binge drinking is on the increase.
Absolutely. Binge drinking is increasing among young people. It's even increasing in the older population as well. And the interesting thing is, as you've said, there's no safe level of alcohol consumption, particularly related to the fetal exposure, but also it's a fallacy that people think, well, you know, I have a binge on a weekend. That translates to moderate drinking and safe. It doesn't. And the science has shown that it doesn't.
Right.
The dangers are just as marked.
Absolutely. And the problem with young people, especially binge drinking, is they're in their reproductive years.
Exactly. And again, during the in the reproductive age range, the potential exposure, fetal exposure, is going to be great. And we just cannot emphasize it enough that a single episode of drinking can in and of itself have an effect if, in fact, that person is within the first trimester of pregnancy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so how long before pregnancy should someone stop drinking?
Well, I'm not sure that there's a specific time frame. In general, what in most toxins, where they happen to be high glucose or high alcohol, the guidelines generally is 3 months before. In other words, if someone was doing these things within 3 months of the pregnancy, it is considered to be within that time frame. So we certainly would advise anyone who is considering pregnancy not to be drinking way ahead of time. But there is no finite time that I would want to recommend, because people may be misunderstood. No. And so it is just not a safe.
Should we rather say that they should start practicing abstinence to keep the baby safe during
Absolutely.
The pregnancy? I think that's where it is, because that's what many of my patients would do. They would say, well, I'm planning a pregnancy, and I would advise them not to take alcohol. They would say, well, maybe afterwards I will, or before, but for that time period. And I think the practice of abstinence is not a bad idea. It's a very good idea.
Particularly as you're planning the pregnancy, you're planning abstinence at the same time.
Exactly.
Because that's precisely what will happen during the course of the pregnancy.
Exactly. Dr. Reese, you're on the Executive Council for the Institute of Medicine. What is their recommendation regarding how much alcohol in pregnancy?
Well, I'm going to make it very simple for all of us. There should be absolute abstinence from alcohol during pregnancy. And because of the lack of a safety threshold. And it's interesting, there's a well-known study, looked at actually 5,000 women in pregnancy who took as little as one drink during the pregnancy. And even those in that study, there's still an increased risk. So at least one to two drinks, wine or beer, in that large study did have an impact. So in fact, there is this very, very strong prohibition against drinking in pregnancy.
Is that one glass a day or one in the entire pregnancy?
Well, no, it's got to be in the first trimester.
But just once in
yes,
the first trimester.
That's correct.
And yet many women don't realize they're pregnant until 6 weeks into the pregnancy.
Precisely.
And that's the whole issue that you were mentioning. And the problem with binge drinking, not only the problem of its effect, but it leads to many unwanted or unplanned pregnancies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a repeating cycle as well. It's a real danger.
Yes, so it's a danger to the fetus, but it's also a danger to get have an unwanted pregnancy.
Absolutely.
And then you're binge drinking again a week later, and I see many of these kinds of pregnancies.
And I think there's a very important theme running here. It's not only in fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, but the theme is being mentioned more and more when it comes to cancer, etc. There is no safe level of alcohol consumption. And fetal exposure, again, emphatically, no safe level, zero.
A big fat zero. It's time to take a break and we'll be right back, so stand by. And we're back. Born with FASD, Jasmine worked hard to graduate with her high school diploma. Dropping out of college, she soon found herself pregnant and now works two jobs. Because her mother drank, she knows she can't multitask, often reads nonverbal cues badly, and is frustrated in social settings. Yet what her doctor advised her in her pregnancy absolutely floored her. Listen to this.
Well, I found out that I was pregnant while I was almost 4 months pregnant. And I kind of knew throughout the time that I was, because I just felt different. And the doctor asked me a serious question. She's like, do you smoke? I'm like, nope, I don't smoke. And she's like, do you drink? I'm like, no, I don't drink. She's like, well, okay, but, you know, a glass of wine is okay. I mean, just as long as you don't overdo it, like, drink every day. I'm like, no, I can't drink. That's a horrible message to send. And I took the time. You realize that on my medical records, it says I'm diagnosed with fetal alcohol syndrome, right? She's like, hold on a second. She looked through my file and actually had to look for it. She's like, oh, my God, you're right. I'm like, why would you tell me a glass of wine is okay to drink? Now, would you tell an alcoholic that? No. And she's like, absolutely not. I'm like, well, you need to have that mind frame always with a pregnant woman. If you wouldn't tell an alcoholic person that, you wouldn't want to tell a pregnant person that. Okay, you need to have that mind frame. And she's like, oh my God, it's definitely something I need to think about. She's and I want to tell you that. I never told my mom that because I don't know why I never told my mom that, but yeah. I don't know, maybe because I was embarrassed. I just want people to know that they are people, okay? Even though they might do outrageous things, they might say the most ridiculous stories or whatever, but you kind of have to see past that and just know in your heart that they are people and they have souls. And to not just disregard them because they say something weird or have a weird behavior. Don't overlook them like that. I think that's the most important message. And because I have so much love for those kind of people. They have like a special place in my heart.
A special place indeed. In the past, medical advice regarding alcohol use in pregnancy was rather nebulous. In fact, 50 years ago, an alcohol infusion would sometimes be used to stop premature labor. Here, Dr. Landless talks about what's changed.
Many things have changed. You know, there's still that rabid debate going on about whether alcohol is good for the heart or not. You're right. The songs have changed over the years. And I think it's important for people to remember that as we've learned more, we become more accountable. And so now that the message is so clearly understood, it's a clarion call for people to think. And we can't recall the past, but what we can do is do better into the future.
Yes, and guide our young ones to make wiser choices and give them that support.
And that's what the message is of saying no safe level.
Mm. Now, I'm thinking about a mom, she's given birth. If she's drinking and she's breastfeeding her baby, if she drinks, that will pass through to the baby, won't it, through the breast milk. What effect does it have on the baby? Because I know a lot of mums think, oh, it'll soothe the baby and calm the baby. Is that true?
it's much more complicated than that. You are right. It does pass freely into the breast milk. But what's interesting is that alcohol actually decreases lactation, and it decreases the ejection of milk from the breast. So if, in fact, she is breastfeeding, not only will the baby be consuming some level of alcohol, but the baby actually consumes less milk because less is being ejected. So at the same time, their nutritional nourishment will actually be less. So sometimes you have a low birth weight baby exposed to alcohol in utero, gets stunted growth or slower, delayed growth because their milk is actually much less. It's very, very complicated, and the mother may, as you said, think that she's doing something very nice for the baby because it may put them to sleep or something of the sort, when in fact it's really creating a problem.
And I, as far as I know, it causes colic. So
yes.
In fact, the babies don't sleep better after a drink. They sleep worse.
That's right.
And that causes more unrest in the home. We all know. None of us like a crying baby, do we? Now, Dr. Landless, these babies are fairly damaged, some of them, right from birth. Does early intervention with those babies, when they're just toddlers, does that help to enhance their cognitive potential?
Absolutely. I mean, the sooner one begins to intervene, the better. The sad thing is that often the diagnosis is missed. Often the facilities are not available. Often individuals do not have the means, or the societies do not have the facilities to help. They need neurology evaluations. They need psychological evaluations. They need occupational therapy. They need physical therapy. They need speech therapy. So there are many of these, this multi-team, disciplinary team approach, which is required, is very expensive. And when I said a little while back in the program, many multiple millions of dollars are spent trying to reverse, or at least to, because you can't reverse the problem, but you can help people to more adequately develop and develop cognitively with their mental skills, their coordination skills, etc. The sooner the interventions begin, the more meaningful the results are going to be. It's never too late to start, but the earlier one starts, the better the outcome.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Now, alcohol will also affect parenting skills and mothering skills. What are these babies at risk for, Dr. Rees?
Well, as I said, the mother who is drinking alcohol and is nursing a child will obviously have an impact directly on the child. But there's also impact on the mother herself. There are highs and there are lows. She may be going to bed with her child and she's slightly intoxicated. Sometimes it's been reported that mothers will roll over on the baby, and you can have crib death sometimes because of the mother rolling over. So you can have a variety of difficulty behavioral problems. So the emotional condition of the mother influences very much the so-called, it's called mothering, and creates an abnormal mothering condition because of the condition the mother is in, while at the same time trying to care for her young. So it's really very, very unfortunate.
Mm. Dr. Landless, you get the last word. How are we going to prevent this problem? Give us some pointers.
I think the message that we've tried to get across is prevention is not only better than cure. In this situation, it is the cure. The message needs to get out. People need to understand. Bottles need to be labeled. Alcohol bottles need to be labeled. This is unsafe for women contemplating pregnancy and during pregnancy. There needs to be so much more publicity about it. We need to educate and educate. All of those factors need to be brought to the knowledge of the public. And I think that as that is done, it's got to be done in a way starting at early ages. You know, to start educating about alcohol or tobacco or other drugs when people are in their late teens, we've missed the boat entirely. Because experimentation, we're told, and we see the figures very clearly, experimentation begins anything from 9 years, 8 years of age upwards, be it in alcohol or tobacco, and even now with marijuana, and we're seeing another debate evolve there. So prevention starts at a very early age. It starts with the environment of the home. It starts in educating the mother and the father and the entire family in trying to promote connected, meaningful relationships, accountability, and an understanding which will help people to be able to have a very positive approach in avoiding these really tragic, heartbreaking issues we've talked about.
Some substances cross the placenta more readily than others, and alcohol is one of them. Drinking during pregnancy can cause miscarriage, stillbirth, and a range of lifelong physical, behavioral, and intellectual disabilities known as fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. Early exposure to alcohol in the first 3 months of pregnancy, especially in higher doses, can cause more significant effects such as difficulty with attention, learning, memory, hyperactivity, speech and language delays, a low IQ, poor reasoning, and judgment. There is no safe amount of alcohol use during pregnancy or when you're trying to get pregnant. Don't take the risk, just don't drink. That's all from me today. Thanks for joining us on Go Health for Good. I'll see you next time.